Yeah, so really pleased to introduce Sonia for today's talk. So Sonia is a postdoc in my group. She's joined in 2019 on a cluster project to look at heterogeneity in social learning and how that might scale to changes in culture. And she chose to do this through sort of looking at this really interesting early period when lots seems to happen in the way that animals learn. And before that, she was a PhD student at the University of Leeds, where she worked on dolphins, doing lots of cool work on social networks and learning there. And prior to that, she was a master's and an undergrad student at the University of Zurich, where she studied both a bit of dolphins as well, and I think more broadly, questions at the anthropology department there. And I'm very pleased to say that Sonia just got an SNF, a Swiss SNF postdoctoral fellowship to leave us soon to go to UC Davis and study social learning in squirrels. So she'll be asking similar questions across a whole broad range of study systems. So with that, I won't take too long. I'll hand over to you.
Thank you, Lucy.
And looking forward.
Thank you very much. Yeah, so I'm very excited to be here today to tell you a little more about my research. And during today's talk, I'll be mainly focusing on the work I've been doing during my postdoc here at the cluster and the Max Planck on the learning strategies in wild birds. Now, animals exhibit huge behavioral diversity across different domains, and large parts of my research are concerned with how such behavioral diversity emerges, with a focus on wild animal populations. So how do individuals acquire their individual specific repertoires? How do they choose which of the behaviors to express? And how does the individual decision-making process then shape the behavioral diversity that is seen on the level of the group or population? And there are three main drivers that shape behavior. First of all, many behaviors have some sort of innate basis, with certain aspects being genetically determined. Second, environmental factors can influence behavior, for example, through variation in resource availability in different locations. And finally, learning processes can determine what sort of behaviors individuals acquire and then express. And these drivers do not act in isolation, but they interact and then together shape the behavior that is ultimately observed. And during today's talk, we're mainly focusing on how learning shapes behavior and how it interacts with a social environment. We distinguish between two major forms of learning. On the one hand, we have asocial or individual learning, and this is the process of generating information by sampling the environment. So asocial learning is beneficial because it generates information that is up to date and adapted to current environmental conditions. However, it can be costly. For example, if the learning requires a lot of trial and error, so it can be very time intensive, or it can also lead to increased mortality, for example, in the context of predator recognition, or when it comes to ingestion of potentially poisonous food where errors might be fatal. So on the other hand, we have social learning, so learning from others, either through direct observation of their behavior or indirectly through interactions or through exposure to locations or objects that they have interacted with. So social learning is essentially scrounging on information that others have produced. And it's potentially a very rapid and safe way to acquire new adaptive behavior. However, social learning social information can potentially become outdated if, for example, the environment changes and then its adaptive value decreases. So to maximize benefits of both asocial and social learning, individuals need to be very strategic in deciding when, who, and what is beneficial to copy from others. They need to employ so-called social learning strategies. Social learning can occur at all ages and life stages, but it is particularly important for young individuals of many species, as they have to acquire the necessary skills for survival, ranging from foraging techniques and diet, over how and where to find shelter, avoid predators, to protocols of social interaction with other individuals. And while social information is particularly important for these young, naive individuals, the value of social information is expected to decrease as they get more experienced themselves. So this is a particularly interesting period to study the mechanisms that underlie the transmission of behavior, the acquisition of behavior, to study what aspects young individuals learn from whom and how these strategies change with age. And this is largely what we will focus on during today's talk. In terms of role models, young individuals have several possible sources for obtaining social information. They can learn through vertical learning from parents. Second, they can obtain information through oblique learning from non-parent adults, so across generations. And finally, they can learn within generations, so from peers through so-called horizontal learning. And much of the previous work on the ontogeny of learning strategies have focused on the transmission of foraging behavior in long-lived species. So those with long dependence periods, such as some cetaceans or primate species. And social learning strategies are very tightly linked to a species' social system, because naturally information can only be transmitted between individuals that are also associated. So in these species with prolonged parental care, these close bonds between parents and offspring provide repeated opportunity for learning and practicing, and therefore vertical learning is often the most important pathway of social transmission, particularly for more complex behaviors or more risky behaviors where asocial learning is potentially costly. During my PhD, I looked at the transmission of tool-using behavior in dolphins. And dolphins are also known for very long periods of dependence between mother and offspring. And young dolphins were found to follow a do-as-mother-does strategy. So they almost exclusively rely on vertical social transmission for learning their foraging behavior. And this leads to these very close behavioral similarities within matrilines as the behavior gets passed on from one generation to the next. We have shown this in a population of dolphins in Western Australia that use marine sponges as foraging tools that you can see there on the left. So they wear these sponges essentially as protective gloves for when they go dig in the sand for buried prey. And using over a decade of behavioral, genetic, and environmental data, we have shown that this behavior is vertically transmitted from mothers to primarily female offspring. So a very typical pathway for species with prolonged parental care. But what happens now in species where the duration of parental care is much shorter? So what learning strategies do young individuals employ when the transition to independence is a lot more fast-paced? And to answer that question, we're taking a big leap in geographic location and species, namely to my current study system, the great tit, which in terms of life history is very much on the other side of the spectrum. So they're relatively short-lived with up to 4 years. And while they do have a dependence periods, the whole transition to independence is relatively short. So great tits are seasonal breeders. In spring, the male will establish a breeding territory within which the female will then build a nest in a tree cavity or a nest box as well if it's provided. She will then lay one egg every day until the clutch is complete and will then incubate the eggs for 13 days until they hatch. Both parents then feed the chicks in the nest until they're ready to fledge, as in leave the nest after about 3 weeks. And I'll be using this term quite a lot during today's talk. So when I refer to fledglings, I'm referring to the young birds that have left the nest. The fledglings then continue to be fed by their parents for another 10 to 30 days. So they roam around in their family groups for a little while within a few hundred meters of their nest box. And then they start feeding themselves and reach full independence. So you can see that the transition from hatching to full independence is a lot more fast-paced. Gray tits have been established as a model organism to study social network dynamics and social transmission of behavior and information, as they can be tracked in the relatively large numbers in the wild using radio frequency identification techniques. And I'll tell you a little more about that in a while. And tits live in these mixed species flocks that you can see at the bottom. And it was found that they rely extensively on social information used in a foraging context, for example, to discover novel food patches. And they rely on information from both conspecifics as well as heterospecifics. And it was found that the information about the location of these food patches follows the social network. So the network structure really determines what sort of social information is available to which individuals. And social information use does not only occur in a foraging context, and I want to give a quick shout out to two former students in the lab, Sally Vistali, who joined us for a master's thesis from the University of Lyon, and Tim Jäger, who did his bachelor's degree here in Konstanz and is actually here in the audience today. Thank you for coming. And they conducted an experiment during spring, deploying several dispensers with colors of with wool of two different colors as mesh lining material, and they have shown in social network analysis frameworks that female gray tits use social information from foraging associates to locate sources of nest material, and then also to that the choice of color was socially influenced. Gray tits are also very capable social learners of behavior, and this has been demonstrated in various cognitive experiments, and actually much of Lucy's previous work has investigated the learning processes in tits using these experimental puzzle boxes, in this case where they have to slide a little door to the left or right to get a food reward. And she has shown that the solutions to these puzzles can spread really rapidly through a population, through horizontal learning among adults. And also that the tits tend to be conformist learners, meaning that they show a preference for the behavior that is shown by the majority of the population. And this conformist learning then leads to these very stable traditions of either left or right within a population. And in a paper that we published earlier this year on some of Lucy's previous data from Wythe and Woods, we showed that gray tits are also capable of learning more complex two-step tasks. So in the first part of the experiment, the birds learned to solve the original sliding door puzzle from trained demonstrators. In the second part, they were introduced to a different puzzle where instead of sliding the door, they had to turn a dial to get a food reward. And again, the solution diffused through the population, starting off with a few trained demonstrators in captivity. And in the third part, the two solutions were then combined into a two-step puzzle. So birds had to combine the slide and dial action to get the reward. This is what it looks like in action. So for receiving the reward, the bird could perform the solves in any order and direction. And here it first goes with a left slide and then I think a downwards dial after a little while. So again, using social network analysis, we found that tits use social information to acquire the one-step solutions, so either dial or slide. But then they recombine them asocially into the full complex two-step task. So overall, without any prior knowledge of either dial or slide, they were very unlikely to solve the complex solve. So meaning that they were not capable of socially learning the entire two-step tasks. Finally, there have been quite a few cross-fostering studies between gray tits and blue tits to provide evidence for social learning during ontogeny. So during cross-fostering, the eggs between the two species are swapped, and then the chicks are essentially raised by foster parents of the opposite species. And it was found that for many of the behaviors that relate to mate choice, foraging, and song productions, the chicks actually showed more similarity to their foster parents rather than their genetic parents, meaning that these behaviors are learned rather than genetically determined. But there are two possible pathways for this learning. First, chicks could have learned directly from their foster parents through vertical transmission during dependence. But alternatively, they could also have been imprinted on their foster species during dependence and then subsequently learned the behaviors from members of the wrong species through either like oblique learning or horizontal learning. So despite the clear evidence of some form of learning during ontogeny, we actually know very little about the underlying mechanisms of social transmission and the learning strategies that these young birds employ early in life. So as part of my postdoc, we decided to shed a bit more light on this very formative period in a fledgling's life. As a first step, we wanted to know more about the social network dynamics of the fledgling's early life, because the network connections essentially determine what information is available to the fledglings while they're transitioning to independence. So how are they established and how do they change as the fledglings age? And we have an amazing field site right on our doorstep with about 200 nest boxes in Möggingen around the woodlands and another 100 just up the hill in Göttingen. And starting in springtime, we monitor these nest boxes regularly to record any breeding activity, nest building, egg laying, start of incubation, hatch date, fledge date, and of course also who is breeding where. And now how do we tell these individuals apart? So during the year, we catch birds in so-called mist nets. We take their measurements, and then most importantly, all birds are equipped with a metal leg ring for permanent identification. And then they additionally get this passive integrated transponder or PID tag that is sealed into this gray plastic ring. And so whenever a PID tag comes into proximity of a receiving antenna, it gets activated and then the logger registers the identity of the bird that is on the antenna. And the same goes for the young birds. So to be able to track them after fledging, we remove them from the nest when they're 15 days old temporarily. They all get a metal leg ring and a PID tag, and then they're before they're put back into the nest. So to look at the ontogeny of social networks, we conducted a study in 2020 in the field site around the castle. Here again, the same map, but this time I've colored all the nest boxes where we have ringed gray tit chicks, which were 229 in total, so quite a lot. And to track their social networks after fledging, we deployed these network feeders that were equipped with these two receiving antenna. So the feeders would then register any visits of PID tag birds as they land on the antenna. And we recorded these visits during the entire breeding season, so from early May till early August, to really get the entire period of them transitioning to independence. From the data stream of these six feeders, we identified distinct groups and then estimated the dyadic relationships between fledglings and all other birds as basically the proportion of times they were seen in the same group. So this value ranges from zero for never seen together to one if they've always been in the same group. And then we tested several predictors of the strength of these dyadic associations. First of all, we wanted to know whether the association strength was dependent on the type of relationship. And we found that fledglings actually showed a very slight preference for associating with siblings and peers, so other juvenile birds, over associating with non-parent adults. And the association strength with parents was showed still quite large variation. Second, we found that overall the association strength with other birds increased as they grew older, so they seemed to increase their social network as they aged. Third, space use overlap, which we calculated as overlap in the use of these six feeders, was a really strong predictor of association strength. And finally, we looked at how the different relationships change with age. And we found that the associations with parents, peers, and non-parent adults, which are the lines at the bottom, they increased with age. While perhaps a little surprisingly, the associations with siblings started off quite strong and then showed a slight decrease over time. So overall, you can see that the associations with other birds change quite drastically throughout this transition to independence, and with it, the availability of social information. And now as a next step, we want to see what consequences this has for the learning strategies that birds employ. So for our experiment, we used an adapted design of the sliding door puzzle that I have previously introduced, and we actually just published a research methods guide with detailed instructions on how to build your own box. And I'm just very briefly going to explain the main functionalities and the modifications that we have added. So very basics, at the front of the box, there's this little sliding door that we've seen that the birds can push either left or right to get access into a mealworm tray to get a food reward. And there's an antenna built into the landing perch of the box that then registers the pit tags of the landing birds. There are two infrared sensors on the inside of the box that then register any movement of the doors and whether it was to the right or to the left. And now we added one more functionality to this original design to make the whole thing selective. So to be able to control if birds got access to the box, and also to define if they got rewarded by solving right or by solving left. So for that, we fitted two little servo motors on the inside that essentially kept the door locked in place and then selectively open to the right, left, or both as defined on an internal access list. Again, this is what it looks like in action. I kind of chose a wide angle shot. So you get an idea of the experimental setup and the surroundings. There's usually quite a few birds that are queuing to get access to the box. And we also always provide a little feeder next to the box to attract the birds to the vicinity. To test the functionality of this box, we conducted a reversal learning experiment in winter, so on the adult birds. We deployed boxes across four populations, and in each of them we introduced demonstrator birds that had learned to solve the box in captivity. And in two populations, this was on the right, in the other two on the left. We then let the behavior diffuse for a few weeks through the population, and then we restricted all knowledgeable birds to their less preferred site, and to see how long it took them until they started solving on their less preferred side. And you can see the solves of one of the population on this figure. So each row is a bird, each dot is a solution. And what we can see is the right solves are in red, the left solves are in blue. And what is very obvious here is that during the first weeks, the solution spread, with the birds preferentially copying the solution that was first introduced here to the right. And then what we found is that birds showed really extensive behavioral flexibility. Almost all of them started solving on their less preferred site without much delay. So with that, we were all ready to actually investigate the ontogeny of learning strategies. We had the box ready. We had a few populations established with knowledgeable birds. So during the next spring, we conducted an experiment on two out of those four populations in Möggingen and Göttingen. And we put the puzzle boxes out at the very start of the breeding season, and entirely unrestricted this time. So we let the solutions diffuse through the adult population from these knowledgeable birds from the previous experiments. Then shortly before the first chicks were ready to fledge from their nest boxes, we put restrictions on the adult birds that were breeding in the study area. So for the breeding pairs that both knew how to solve the box, we forced about half of them to solve on the same side. So either both right or both left. And the other half to solve on opposite sides. So one right and one left. Then we had breeding pairs where only one was knowledgeable, which we restricted to either right or left. And finally, we had controls of breeding pairs where none of them knew how to solve the box. And throughout the entire breeding season, we then kept the boxes out for 4 days each week and automatically collected data on the solving behavior of both the adults and the fledglings as they entered the populations after fledging, including when they started solving and what solutions they produced over time. And on 2 out of the 3 days where we had removed puzzle boxes for cleaning and data download, we put the network feeders out to keep track of the social networks and also keep track of who was using the area but never learned to solve the puzzle box. And both the adults and fledglings participated very eagerly in the experiment. So I had 103 fledglings that were ringed and then also seen in the area after. And over half of them managed to solve the box and produced over 10,000 solutions. So having these really large amounts of data allowed us to ask very detailed questions on the mechanisms underlying the learning during that time. So who do fledglings learn from? Who do they choose as role models? Do they show a preference for the parental side? And what do they do when the information they get from the parents is conflicting? Do they update the preferences in light of changes in their social networks? And also, how important is personal experience versus social information? So starting at the very top, who do fledglings learn from? We approached this question from different angles. First of all, we wanted to investigate potential evidence for vertical social learning from parents. And we hypothesized that if fledglings acquired any knowledge about the puzzle box from their parents during dependence, that fledglings with knowledgeable parents would be faster at learning to solve the box themselves. So we modeled the latency in days after fledging until they produced their first solutions. And we found that fledglings with 2 solving parents at the very top were faster at producing their first solution compared to those with only 1 solving parent. And then those with solving parents were considerably faster at producing the first solution compared to those with no solving parents. Second, we also found that fledglings with parents that solved at higher frequencies during dependence were faster at producing their first solution. So it does appear that the solving behavior of the parents during dependence had an influence on the speed with which fledglings learned to solve the box. Next, we asked a bit more of a detailed question to really tease apart who then the role models were for learning to solve the box. As we have seen that the relationships with other birds changes quite drastically during transition to independence, and with it the availability of social information. So we ran a so-called network-based diffusion analysis, which is a modeling framework to measure the importance of social learning and also to tease apart different pathways of transmission. So NBDA tracks the spread of a behavior through a social network and then infers that it is socially learned if the diffusion follows the network connections, because it's based on the assumptions that more closely associated individuals are also more likely to learn from one another. And to analyze the diffusion of the puzzle box solutions, we created a social network based on the association strength from the network feeders that we had used. And to account for the fact that these associations change over time as fledglings age and also that fledglings enter the population and leave, we did this in a dynamic framework. So we're recalculating the networks every week. And to investigate the different pathways, we essentially subset the network into 4 subnetworks to only allow transmission between particular individuals. So in the first network, we tested for the importance of vertical learning, so by only allowing connections between parents and offspring. In the second one, we only had connections between non-parent adults and fledglings to measure the importance of oblique learning. A third network had connections among siblings, so testing for horizontal learning. And a fourth network, again, another horizontal one, but this time with connections among non-siblings only. And from the puzzle box data, we extracted when fledglings produced their first solution, and then took that as diffusion data. And we created models with all possible combinations of the 4 networks. And overall, we found very strong evidence for models with social learning against those without social learning. So it seems that the diffusion of the puzzle box was very strongly influenced by social learning. And when looking at the possible pathways, we found most support for models that included the parent-offspring network, the one between non-parent adults and fledglings, and the one among siblings. So essentially a mix of vertical, oblique, and horizontal learning among siblings. And when looking at effect sizes, perhaps a little surprisingly, we found the strongest effect for learning among siblings with 46% of the events, followed by 28 between non-parent adults and fledglings, and only 26 between parents and offspring. So overall, quite a mix of role models. So for both the analyses on the latency and NBDA, we only really looked at the first solutions that the fledglings produced, so when did they learn to solve the box, but we disregarded all subsequent solutions and also did not look at the decision making between left and right. So for this last analysis, we want to look at the mechanisms that underlie the decision making between the side choices. So we're looking now at the entire data set and not just the first few solutions. In this figure again, you can see the solutions that were produced during the entire time of our experiment at the 2 sites, site 1 on the left, site 2 on the right. And again, each row is an individual, each dot a solution. So you can see they have eaten quite a lot of mealworms. And at the top, we have the adults, and at the bottom, we have the fledglings. So first, we wanted to investigate the rules underlying the decision-making during the fledglings' first initial solves. So we only really considered the first 10 solves of each fledgling. And for these next few models that I'm going to show, we're always testing what predicts the proportion of solves on the right side. So that will mostly be on the y-axis in the next few figures. In this first model, we tested for delayed production. So essentially testing whether the side choices of parents during dependence influenced an individual or fledgling's first few decisions after reaching independence. However, we found no evidence that the side choices of parents during dependence had any influence on the fledgling's initial side choices. And this was regardless of whether the fledgling had gotten conflicting information from the parents or not. However, when we looked at the importance of social influence on these first few decisions, we found very strong evidence. So to measure the influence of social, to measure the impact of social influence, we always looked at what other birds have produced in the 5 minutes prior to a fledgling making a decision. And we found very strong evidence that the proportion of right solves that others produced also influenced the proportion of solves then that the fledgling produced. Next, we looked at the entire data set, and we were wondering about whether there were any attention bias is towards particular role models and potentially how these change over time. So now we're looking at the entire 10,000 SOFs, but now we're distinguishing between social information depending on the identity of the solver that produced the SOFs in the few minutes before each fledgling made a decision. So we differentiated between parents, non-parents, adults, siblings, and non-siblings, as we've done earlier. And overall, we found that the reliance on social information decreased with increasing experience. So judging by the slopes that are decreasing as the fledglings get more experience in solving. And furthermore, we found no evidence that fledglings actually distinguished between different role models, so they seem to really just lump all the social information into one, so regardless of the identity of the solver. Okay, so we have analyzed this data from very different angles, and I want to just take a minute to kind of put it all back into bigger pictures. So first, we've seen that the fledglings with solving parents and those with parents that solve at higher frequencies were faster at producing their first solutions. So it seemed like early exposure did facilitate learning, possibly due to local enhancement. So an attraction to the puzzle box site as a result of being fed there during dependence. And this is actually that was evident from some of our videos. You will see the fledgling here on the left, and its parent will fly in a minute. And what we can see is that they're being fed straight from the box, and also that the fledgling is not paying any attention whatsoever to what the parent is actually doing, but is just really focused on getting that worm. A couple of weeks later, when fledglings started to grow more independent from their parents and actually had to look for their own food, we found many situations like these, where several fledglings were surrounding the puzzle boxes, clearly no clue whatsoever how to get to the worm. But also what's really interesting is that they really seem to be exploring together. So they're very much attracted to sites that other birds peck at. So it really seems that they're trying to use each other as sources of social information. And this is actually very nicely supported by our NBA analysis as well. So we found most support for transmission among siblings, and only then followed by learning from parents and non-parent adults. And that suggests that the acquisition of the behavior only occurs after being separate from their parents. And the fact that they are supposedly learning very strongly from their siblings is unsurprising, given that they have these really close social bonds right after being independent from their parents. So they really do seem to explore and learn from one another during that period. Then for site choice, we initially found that fledglings initially use social information, but also that they do not distinguish between different role models. And then with increasing experience, they largely prefer personal over social information for the site choices. And this is consistent with a strategy to learn socially when you're uncertain. And finally, we found no evidence that there was any learning during dependence, so no evidence for delayed production. And this is in contrast to a very similar study on juvenile hihis. These are small pasture birds native to New Zealand. And they were provided with feeders that could be entered from two different sides. And initially they found that the side choices of these fledglings were influenced by their parents' side choice, but then as the fledglings grew independent and started hanging out in these like fledgling flocks, they updated their site choice in light of whatever the majority within their flock was showing. So in our study, overall, we found that fledglings employed quite a mix of many strategies over a very small timescale. So initial reliance on social learning, but not distinguishing between role models, and then also trading that with asocial information as they got more experienced. And this is in contrast to many species with these longer periods of parental cares that I have introduced earlier that rely extensively on vertical social learning. So in the great tits, perhaps the duration of parental care is simply too short for adopting such complex behaviors from parents. So they only really did the initial step of the learning, which was the local enhancement. Relying on a mix of role models and balancing social and asocial information is not a bad thing, though, because it does generally allow for a more rapid response to environmental changes. And great tits have indeed been able to react quite flexibly to changes in the environment. So in experiments, for example, that changed the payoff of the behavior, the great tits were found to quite flexibly adopt then the higher, more payoff solution through a combination of social information use and personal experience. What we haven't talked about, and I actually haven't looked at yet, is the role of scrounging. Because many adult birds, never actually figured out how to solve the box themselves. But they will quickly fly in after somebody else solves and pick out a word. So that's their strategy. This is what they do. And it would be quite interesting to see whether the fledglings of scrounging parents would be more likely to adopt such a strategy. Also because the complexity of learning the scrounging is possibly not as high as actually solving the box. And another point that would be interesting to look at is actually the influence of developmental age on the learning strategies. Because in our models, we looked at the changes in learning strategies as a function of experience, so measured in the number of days that the fledglings had already been solving. But if fledglings start solving at different ages, the experience and the developmental age are not necessarily correlated. So that would be interesting to look at in light of developmental age. So this work on the ontogeny of social networks and learning processes is all in the process of being wrapped up and hopefully ready for publication some point soon. This is what I'm mainly focused on today. I have briefly touched upon some other work that we've done in passing, but I'm of course happy to discuss any more in detail after the talk if people are interested. We're also currently working on one project looking at tipping point dynamics in a social context, essentially testing whether established side preferences in a population can be overthrown by dedicated minorities that just consistently solve on the other side. So happy to discuss that later if anyone's interested. And with that, I'm at the end of my talk. I want to say thank you to the cluster and Lucy for having me join for this postdoc over the last 3 years. All current and former members of the lab, of course, particularly Gustavo and Michael, the TIT team, who I've worked with very closely the last few years. And then, of course, all the countless bird ringers and fieldwork helpers. It's very hard work to establish and maintain so many wild populations of birds. And thank you for coming, and oh, good timing. I will be happy to take questions. Thank you.
Well, thank you so much for this very interesting talk on some exciting research. Are there any questions in the room?
Yep. I guess I can stop sharing.
Thank you very much for the talk. I just wanted to ask whether you expect the fledglings from parents that are scrounging more to really scrounge more themselves, because if they are not learning from the parents how to solve the box, would they learn how to scrounge in a way?
Mm-hmm. It's a very good question. Based on what I found here is that they are attracted through the box but don't essentially learn to solve the box from their parents. With the scrounging, it could go both ways, I think. Because either there will not be enough time to learn that behavior from the parents, but what's also possible is that it's a question of complexity. Because often for these complex behaviors, it is required that there's quite a long period where they can observe and practice, and it's possible that for actually learning to solve the box, the time wasn't enough to really acquire that from parents. But the scrounging is not as difficult, because all you need to do is be quick enough to fly in and pick out a worm after someone else was doing it. So it's possible that due to reduce complexity of the behavior, that there might actually be some vertical transmission going on. But I'll look at that and let you know.
Any more questions?
Yes. Yeah, so then generally that is there evidence for like a selective copying, like dominant ones or male male? Did you look at that, or is there any other studies
for
that?
Selective copying for particular sexes, or was that your question?
Sexes and dominant and more like simply exposure.
Yeah, good question. I did not look at that. I for now just lumped all the parents into just breeding pairs that we're solving. But it's a very good question. What would be interesting to look at is that if the fledglings preferentially copy the same sex behavior. Because of the different dispersal strategies, it would kind of make sense. Because in tits, the females tend to disperse while the males stay in their natal territories. So it would be interesting to see whether there's any biases towards the same sex behavior. Unfortunately, we don't know the sex of the fledglings, so that we can't tell them apart. But that would be something really exciting to look at. Mm-hmm.
So I might have missed this, but how did you define the individual solves? Because this system, since it's a binary choice, it would be really easy to just do trial and error. And if you're registering only a solution as one time they get a reward, then they could just trial and error the rewards and get. So did you control for this at all, or do you just register a solution when they solve it and they get a reward?
I only got half of it, sorry.
So since the system's just a binary choice, so the birds could in principle go up and just try both sides, mm-hmm. and then whenever they got a reward from one, you would register it as a solve. Is that correct?
Yes.
So did you try controlling for this to see if they do an incorrect solution and then a correct solution and wash that all out and not include that in the data set?
So the box would register any solve to any side. So even if they did one after the other, it would register that as two independent solves. Obviously, what we don't know is if they actually managed to get a worm out or if they're just kind of solved and then didn't get rewarded. No, we did not control for that.
And then the more complex two-step thing, I guess this would be a good control for this. And so this was just a thought that popped into my head.
Yeah.
So did you think about that with that data too? If you're doing a two-step solution, it's obviously much harder than just doing this binary one or the other.
Yes. So with the two-step task, it records all the steps that they do. And what I haven't mentioned is that that last part, the two-step task, was actually split into two experimental steps. So in the first one, they were still rewarded for producing a single solution, so either slide or a dial, they got a sunflower seed, and only if they combined the both, they got a mealworm, which is the more attractive reward. And then in the next generation, next winter, only the two-step task got rewarded. But what was interesting that they continued to produce these like single solutions even though they were no longer rewarded. So it seemed that producing that step was an important part of the learning to get to the full thing.
Yeah. If you showed this and I missed it, I'm sorry then. I'm wondering if you have if you make a change of how they solve the puzzle, if it's one side or the other, can they learn to then do it the other way? And would social versus personal information in this case, like already changing an already learned strategy, you think follow the same pathways or weights?
Mm-hmm. It's a good question. Actually, in the behavioral flexibility experiment that I showed, we also controlled for whether the connections to knowledgeable birds influenced the speed with which they were able to change, and that had no influence, indicating that they actually the switching occurred mainly through asocial learning. So once they knew how to solve one side, they were more quickly to try the other side without actually any social input.
You mentioned there's multiple species that are being studied, but you were looking at the great tits. Is there enough diversity in their social systems that you could forward predict how you think this would be different in, say, a marsh tit or a blue tit or other various birds I know nothing about?
That is a good question. I wouldn't dare to predict what the learning would look like, but I would assume they are relatively similar in their social system, so it's probably something very similar. We do have occasionally blue tits and nuthatches that solve the box, but generally the box is very much made for the size of the great tits. The blue tits are usually too weak to solve the box, so they more specialized on scrounging. Marsh tits very occasionally solve it, but
offspring stay with their parents all winter with the marsh tits.
Right, okay. So Lucy just said that the offspring in the marsh tits, they stay with the parents all winter, so that might actually be something really interesting to look at, the whether the length of the developmental period then changes whether they learn or not. So it's a bit of an issue that the great tits are usually very dominant over others. So if you have I had cases where I had a big dominant male in the area that couldn't solve the box itself, but would definitely make sure no one else could even sit on the perch in front of the box. So I don't think any other, the other species would actually get around to solving enough to, would have to somehow restrict access to small birds only.
Yeah, thanks for the talk, by the way, really good. And I think I've just been wondering, have you guys kept these puzzle boxes out in the wild through the seasons? And what kind of, I don't have an idea or something, but is there a value in a long-term study on this kind of puzzle and social learning system? If we keep these boxes out there for 10 years, is there, I don't know, or is it more a short-term diffusion thing?
It's yes and no. We have never kept them out for just seeing what happens over time, but it's mostly been specific experiments. But we have definitely I've done work during the breeding season, and I've done work during winter. And I think for me, the most striking differences was in social tolerance. During the breeding season, there's increased social tolerance between the parents and their fledglings, of course, and also among the juvenile birds. So they would often perch all together on the puzzle box, all staring at the door, which will never happen among the adults in winter. So for me, what I found that the diffusion was actually a lot faster during the spring than during winter, even though they're probably a lot more hungry during winter and should be more motivated. But I know, for example, Lucy has done some projects over several seasons or several winters in a row to look at whether the established site preferences are maintained, and that was actually the case. So they did remember from the previous winter what to solve, and the new birds then went with whatever the majority showed. So this was these stable traditions over I don't know, three to four winters
years.
Even, yeah. So,
but also we found that the diffusion was faster, but this is n of three. We also found the diffusion was faster in colder winters than in more mild winters. So I think that's that exactly what Sonia highlighted, that there's an effect of the environment and there's an effect of the social tolerance, like, together.
Mm-hmm. All right, everybody satisfied, that's brilliant. Okay, then I think we're finished here. Thank you again for coming and giving us this really nice insight into your research. We're hoping to see a open access publication of this very soon. Come and see me if you have any questions on that. Okay, enough self-advertising. As said before, this was the last talk in this semester, so have a nice summer and we'll meet in this very spot again in October. Thank you for coming.